Buddy, on this fine Halloween day, I'd like to call to order the joint interim special committee on public education appropriation. Alethea is here as our analyst, and we will be taking invited testimony today from a number of individuals. Then we will be meeting again during legislative days to take action. That'll be kind of like the work session. Okay, Alethea, anything for the good of the order before we start?
No, I think we can go ahead.
Okay, the first thing on the agenda is adoption of interim committee rules.
And those are?
There should be a paper copy in front of everyone.
These are the same rules that we've operated on before when this committee has met. Alethea, anything new or unusual?
No substantive changes, co-chairs, that would necessarily affect this meeting.
Therefore, Chairman Rowe, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated October 31st, 2017.
Okay, Representative Smith Warner has moved adoption of proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Rules are adopted. Okay, and committee members, Madam Co-Chair, why don't you introduce your House members, and then I'll take over with the Senate members.
Certainly, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I am Representative Barbara Smith Warner from House District 45. Shall I let you introduce yourselves, colleagues?
We could do that.
All right. Sorry.
I am State Representative Margaret Doherty from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland.
Good morning, State Representative Gene Wisnett, representing House District 53, Redmond, Sun River, Tumalo, parts of Bend, and Deschutes County.
Thank you. And I am Senator Rod Monroe, District 24, which is mid-Multnomah County and some of northern Clackamas County. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, I'm Senator Roblin, Senate District 5. So it goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and then into Sheridan and Falls City in the valley part of seven counties.
And Senator Brian Boquist will be joining us later. Brian Boquist is a senator from the mid-county area around McMinnville and...
He's one of my bordering counties.
Wine country. And unlike California, our wine country didn't burn. Okay, Letha, where are we?
Next, we can close the organizational meeting. We finish the introductions.
Okay. Close the organizational meeting.
And then open the informational meeting.
Open an invitational meeting.
And then I can start everyone off with a brief presentation on reviewing just ballot measure one and the previous reports.
Okay.
So for the record, my name is Alethea Miller. I'm Legislative Analyst with Legislative Policy Research Office. And then thank you, Co-Chairs Smith Warner and Senator Monroe for allowing me to do this presentation today. So what I'm going to do is go over just an overview of the ballot measure, which is ballot measure one. So I'm going to talk to you about the committee's charge, committee's responsibilities for K-12 education, post-secondary education, the option for alternative methodology if you choose not to do a report, which has not been done historically, and then an overview of the previous reports, and then the deadline for the report. So the committee's charge, as the members of this committee are aware, Oregon voters enacted ballot measure one in November of 2000. From that, that's why now in our Constitution, it mandates that the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law and publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient or identifies the reasons for the insufficiency in the report. And we've been doing these reports since 2001 when the statutes were established. Everyone in front of you also has paper copies of the statutes. Those were printed, and they're also available on OLIS. So next I'll talk to you about the committee's responsibilities, specifically in terms of K-12 education. So the committee is going to determine, based on the testimony and the information given from the Quality Education Commission, whether or not the appropriation made by the Legislative Assembly is sufficient to meet the quality goals that have been established. So that would mean that the committee would either choose in the report to say that we have demonstrated sufficiency in the funding, or the committee can do what has been done in years past, which is identify insufficiency in the funding. And that has been what has been identified since 2001 when the reports have been published. In order to identify insufficiency, the committee would need to indicate the reasons the amount appropriated is not sufficient, identify the extent of the insufficiency, and the impact of the insufficiency on the ability of the state system of K-12 public education to meet quality goals, and also include in the report how the amount appropriated in the budget may affect both the current practices and student performance identified by the commission.
And I believe that in all of the times that this committee has done this, they have never found that the resources were, in fact, sufficient.
Yes, Co-Chair Monroe, that is absolutely correct.
Thank you.
And I'll also be going over the previous reports and the findings, and I'll indicate that for the committee as well. And so next I'll talk to you about the committee's responsibilities, specifically in relation to post-secondary education. So the Legislative Assembly, which is this committee, shall identify in the report whether the state system of post-secondary public education has quality goals established by law. That's also identified in statute. That's where that comes from. So this committee would need to demonstrate sufficiency. So if there are quality goals, Legislative Assembly shall include in the report a determination the amount appropriated in the budget is sufficient to meet those goals. In the last report, the report identified 40-40-20 as something like a quality goal, even though that's more of a numerical goal where it identifies specific data and levels this committee would need to meet. In the end of the report, when it discusses post-secondary education, it addresses 40-40-20 as the quality goal. And we have stakeholders here from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission who will talk a little bit more about that. And then the other option is to identify insufficiency. And by doing that, it's very similar to K-12, whether or not the amount appropriated is not sufficient, the extent of the insufficiency, and the impact on the insufficiency of the ability of the state system of post-secondary public education. Make that clear. This is specific to public education, again, similar to K-12.
Mr. Kutcher.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I think it's, Ms. Miller, you're saying we've never met or we've always been insufficient, but there's only two reports, and this bill was passed in 2000. So you provide us two reports. Is there more reports? Is it required to do the report every budget? But we don't have, and were the reports?
Go ahead. Yeah. So Vice Chair Wisnett, co-chairs Smith Warner and Monroe. That's a great question. So in terms of the reports, no, there is a report since the beginning.
Okay.
The only reports that we uploaded online were the last two, since that is the historical precedent. We upload from the last 4 years. If you want, we can absolutely upload all the reports.
Follow up, Mr. Coaching. I guess my question overall concern is, are we seeing the same things? Are we seeing something new? We've been reporting since 2000. And we haven't met the goals or provide sufficient funding. It looks like after that many years, we'd have some things we could really focus in on, or what are they different each year, or how do we evaluate that? Are we going to do the same thing with this report we've done in the past and just say, yeah, we want more, but there's not there money there? Or has anyone analyzed all the reports to see if it's a trend or something to really focus in on, like Representative Wisnett, and with the help of my colleagues on this side, we focused on ELL and poverty students. that if we're going to, you know, get rid of losing 10,000 students a year, that that group of students, I think, needs to be focused. We've got $12 million now we've set aside for ELL, but so, I, you know, we can do a report again, but, you know, looks like that many years we'd be able to focus in and correct something.
That's an excellent question. There have been changes over the, what, 18 years now that we've been under this mandate. Sometime we've come closer than other times. Sometimes the insufficiency has been more in one area or in another area. And so seeing the trends and seeing where we've come since 2001 in terms of the level of insufficiency and you know, whether we're making up any ground or not, I guess is what my good colleague, Representative Wisnett, is asking, and I think that would be very nice for us to know. So maybe you could dig into that a bit and give us another report when we meet again during the legislative days, what, in about 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Senator Boquist.
Just as a follow-up that, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, to Senator Wisnett's question is it would be good to have a report and then maybe almost a simplified matrix from the beginning to now and saying, because I'm certain that there are key measures, key performance measures in each of these areas, and let's, you know, did we make these in these years? I mean, we've had 9 reports. Are there 6 of them that we've covered that they're consistently deficient, or we've covered them, and what is sort of left over, some historical perspective? Or, God forbid, that, you know, maybe this whole process isn't what we ought to be doing anyway because we're not really making any ground at all. Not that we want to get it earth-shattering in the February session, Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair.
I also want to say I apologize for my throat. It's fighting off a cold, but absolutely, Vice Chair Wisnett, Vice Chair Boquist, and Senator Monroe, great points, and I can absolutely do something where I can analyze the trends and kind of see the changes. My understanding from the reports is they haven't differed drastically, but that is something where we can absolutely look into, you know, where exactly is the money going, and you brought up a great point with ELL and poverty, and if we're doing that in the next biennium, maybe it might be different going forward.
Yes, we shall.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you,
Madam President.
Thank you. And so then, just as everyone is aware, there is always the option. There's always the option for the committee to pursue an alternative methodology. So the option there is for the committee to not necessarily do a report, but you can pursue a different type of methodology. But you would need to focus on research, data, public values. And also the performance of successful schools, professional judgment, or a combination of both. This is not something that the committee has pursued in the past, but it's always an option if you would choose not to do a report and do some kind of, you know, long-standing research study, that would be an option.
And in a few minutes, we're going to hear from a couple of members of the commission and also from Brian Reeder, and perhaps they'll elucidate what we're delving into here.
Yeah, absolutely. And they actually might be great, too, to answer the questions you brought up about the trends and the reports. I think Brian and the two co-chairs from the Quality Education Commission might be able to provide more insight on that as well. So now just go over an overview of the previous reports, kind of to answer Representative Wisnett's questions as well. So from 2001 to 2003, this was the first report. What they identified was K-12 funding was insufficient, and the extent of the insufficiency was $1.142 billion. The legislature appropriated $5.202 billion, and then this was reduced after the 2002 special session to $4.919 billion. And then that's also attributed to the extent of the insufficiency. For the 2003-2005 report, the K-12 funding was again insufficient. The extent of the insufficiency was $2.095 billion. And then for the following year, 2005 to 2007, K-12 funding was found insufficient. The extent was $1.729 billion. The legislature did appropriate $5.24 billion, and this was increased to $5.306 billion in the second year. And despite this, there was still insufficiency.
Oh, yeah. That's $2 billion.
From 2007 to 2009, K-12 funding was found to be insufficient, and the extent of the insufficiency was $1.6337 billion, and the amount originally appropriated by the legislature was reduced due to the declining forecast to $6.1323 billion. And in 2009-2011, K-12 funding was again found to be insufficient. The legislature appropriated $6 billion, but this later was reduced to $5.753, and the extent of the insufficiency overall was $2.597. And then in 2011-2013, K-12 funding was again insufficient, and the extent of the insufficiency was $3.04 billion. 2013 to the 15 report, K-12 funding was insufficient with a $2.095 billion extent of the insufficiency. And it was later reduced, the legislative appropriation was reduced to 4.9 after the failure of Measure 30. And then in the 2015-2017, that was the most recent report for this biennium. Similar results, K-12 funding was found to be insufficient, and the extent was $1.814 billion. And then for the next report that we write, it would be for the 2017-2019 biennium. And the deadline for this report is 180 days after signee die, which is about the first week of January. And then we wanted to have the first meeting in October. That was at the request of the Speaker's office and the Senate President's office.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mrs. Miller, this is good. I probably should have seen this before I ask my questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important. My colleague here said, you know, the recession was really bad in 3 and 5, and that was a, but if you look at, there was only 2 years we had over $2 billion. I think that I'd like to see added to these slides the overall budget and what percentage. I know my colleagues in the education community are talking about how when I first came in this building, it was education, K-12 was about 50%. Mm-hmm. And I remember Speaker Menace actually had a bill that she was talking about saying we're going to make K-12 50% of the budget. And I think this last budget was 31%. So that would be good little quick summary data to see, you know, what was the overall budget and how much of that was K-12 and higher ed. If we're looking at those.
Mm-hmm.
If they've, because we've gone from the 50% almost to now 31%. Also in our, all of us, I think except Senator Boquist, and during the Ways and Means committees, we kept looking at cost drivers and how important cost drivers are. If your cost drivers are eating up all your increases, you're not really gaining. I don't know if they addressed those in all those reports or not as far as what was, if it's, you know, we have no health care in PERS. We saw that this time, and more of the dollar going to K-12 is going for those benefits. That would be, I think, good information to look at if we're trying to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Wisnett, our co-chairs, Monroe and Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, thank you very much for the comments and the feedback. And yeah, absolutely, I can come back with some information that includes like the overall budget, the comparison between K-12 and higher ed, and also just the more in relation to the general landscape and the overall cost drivers going on. Mm-hmm. You brought up a good point with the recession.
Senator Monroe.
Representative Maggie.
Okay. I just think the one thing that you have to realize is that you can look at the numbers, but you also have to look at the reasons behind the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to, as a committee, keep that clear, because you can go through and say, well, in 2003, they did whatever. Well, in 2003, school districts did not get the last 6 months of their basic school support. They just flat out didn't get it. And that was the time that all of the school districts are closing early and so on and so forth. So I think it's just, you know, it's when you look at statistics, I think you need to look at all the statistics, and part of it is the cost driver behind that and so on. So just a little bit of comment. caution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Doherty, thank you. Thank you for the comment. I'll take that into consideration as well when I write that.
I mean, the whole PERS situation and other things that are changing, some of which, many of which, the school districts really can't control, and it, you know, makes a huge difference. And then the overall economy, you notice that in the recession years of 01, 02, we were way down and then picked up a little bit, and then we hit the 08 time where it was horrible. Now things are improving a little bit again, but there are other cost drivers that we, the legislature, have not solved yet. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Are we ready for testimony now?
Yes, I believe the next group up is Brian Reeder and the Quality Education Commission co-chairs.
Brian and the Quality Education Commissioners, come on up. Mr. Reeder is the only one here that's been around almost as long as I have.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, for the record, I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the assistant superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the Department of Education. And with me today, Beth Giroux, who is co-chair of the Quality Education Commission, and Sarah Boley, the other co-chair of the Quality Education Commission. I have a relatively short PowerPoint to give you an overview of both the commission and the quality education model. But before I do that, you raised a question of whether we're making any progress in closing what's been identified as the funding shortfall. And you don't have this in front of you, and I don't have it in the PowerPoint, but I happen to have it with me, in the 2016 QEM report on page 12, it shows a table that looks at the gap in funding between the legislative appropriation and what the Quality Education Commission has recommended, which really is the basis for the Measure 1 comparison that Ms. Miller just gave you. And if you take a look at that, what you'll see is that in 1999-01 biennium, which is really when the quality ed model was first used in the funding discussions, the gap between the recommended funding level for the state school fund and what the legislature actually appropriated was 23.9%. It was about just a little over $1 billion. Then the recession of the early 2000s hit, and that went up to about 36% over the next two biennia, that gap. Then as we came out of that recession, that gap started to fall again, down to 34% in 2005-2007 and 27% in 2007-2009. Now, even though the recession had started then, we had a pretty good size rainy day fund in Oregon that allowed continued funding of schools without making dramatic cuts. Even though state revenue had already started downward, there was money in the rainy day fund that allowed stability in funding for a while. The recession was so long that the rainy day fund was empty. So the gap went up to 37% in 2009-11, reached its peak of 38% in 2011-13, and then has come down again. And in the last two biennia, with dramatically higher funding of the state school fund by the legislature. We're down in the 25% range now. So we're back to where we started back in 1999. So I guess the story is we've made little or no progress, primarily because of the economy and its impact on state revenue. We still have a state revenue system that's very sensitive to the economy, heavily dependent on both personal and corporate income taxes. So just a little bit more detail on what Ms. Miller presented to you earlier. Still a considerable gap and very sensitive to state revenue and the economy.
And if you go back before the ballot measure, back into the, say, the 70s and 80s, when I was a young legislator, in those days, sometimes schools were actually closing because they couldn't pass budgets. And we worked very hard. I was the author of something called the School Safety Net, which I think was in 87 when I was chair of the Revenue Committee. And the School Safety Net simply said, if you try three times to pass a budget and fail, you can budget, you can spend what you had the previous year with no growth. And that wasn't an answer, but it kept schools open, at least for a time being. But this is a problem that goes way back, back, you know, before my time even. And it is a problem that, even though we're trying to solve it and the ballot measure is supposed to attack that, obviously we still have problems, and school funding has never been adequate. It's just a level of inadequacy. And Representative Doherty, who has been hanging around doing this job about as long as I have, understands this as well, that both of us, we got to know each other when we were young people at the Tigard School District. Okay, Brian, go ahead.
Okay, I've got, I think, 12 slides here on the PowerPoint, and it's a real high-level overview of both the commission and the model itself, and then we'll just open it up for questions to the committee of all three of us.
Okay.
So, a brief history of the QEM. It actually started back in 1997 with Representative Lynn Lundquist when he was the Speaker of the House, really out of, I think, frustration that the education budget tended to be left till last in the sessions, and was sort of a victim to whatever was left, hadn't yet been appropriated. So his view was that if we knew how much it cost to run a really highly effective system of schools, it might influence how the appropriation was made and perhaps improve the level of funding for schools. The model was initially built by Professor Dave Conley, who's at the U of O, with the help of Nancy Heiligman, who was the business manager for the Eugene School District and then worked at the Department of Education for a number of years during those early years of the model. The first report came out in 1999, and then starting at that point, it was published every 2 years, and actually the second report was actually in 2000, so it's just a one-year gap there, but then every 2 years. So the 2016 report was the 10th report of the commission, and this upcoming report next August will be the 11th QEM report. In 2001, the legislature put the Quality Education Commission into statute, It was initially created by an executive order. And the commission has been updating and improving and enhancing the model over that period. The charge of the commission is in statute, and it really asks the commission to do three things, and those are to determine the amount of funding required to run a highly effective system of schools in Oregon, K-12 schools. And perhaps more importantly, to dig into educational practices and build into the model the best practices that research tells us are out there, and then to use the model to determine what it would cost to, in essence, buy all the inputs required to implement those practices. And obviously those key inputs are teachers and other staff, but also supplies, services, computers, all those things that it takes to run large organizations or in even small organizations. We have some rather small school districts in the state, but all of those inputs that really are required to run a effective school system. And then issue the report both to the governor and the legislature about what the commission has found. And so in that report, the commission talks about current practices in K-12, the costs of continuing current practices, and the expected student performance under those current practices and funding levels. And then to talk about best practices, the costs of those, and expected student performance under those practices and funding levels. And then to present two alternatives for meeting the Oregon's education goals. And typically, those alternatives have been around a path to getting to full funding, recognizing that adding roughly $2 billion more dollars to the state school fund and to our K-12 schools all at once both isn't practical from a funding point of view, but also is such a large influx of money all at once that may not be used effectively in the system. I know if my income, went up by 30% all at once, I might blow some of that in unpredictable and not so useful ways. So recognize both that a phase in both recognizes the impracticality of both the funding side and the spending side. And typically the phase-in period that the commission has advocated has been a five biennia or a 10-year phase-in where, roughly 10% of the gap is reduced each year until the funding level is up to where the full recommended level is achieved.
So, Brian, let me see if I understand what you're saying. We know that class sizes are way higher than is recommended in the quality education pattern. But if we, in 1 year, went from where we are now to what is recommended in terms of class size, you'd have to hire an awful lot of new teachers, and it takes a while for our schools of education to gear up to actually train that many new teachers and so on, and it just couldn't happen in 1 year. So phasing it in over time certainly makes sense.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, that's exactly right. And I think there's a very useful lesson from California. And this was, 10 or more years ago, maybe longer. Time flies. But they passed a law requiring much lower class sizes throughout the state of California. California's got 40 million people and probably roughly 10 times as many people as Oregon and 10 times as many students. So they've got about 5 million K-12 students, where we have 550,000. And they struggled to find qualified teachers to accomplish that class size reduction, and I think they would acknowledge that they hired a lot of teachers who were not qualified and not effective, and that they regarded that very quick attempt to reduce class sizes as to be a mistake. As with anything else, planning takes time, and useful, effective use of resources takes good planning. So a little bit about the model itself. The model really takes pretty much all of the data that we collect on schools in Oregon and brings it into one place in a coherent description of what we spend on our schools and the student performance that results from that. And the model is a kind of model called a professional judgment model, and that what that means is that the level of resources and the types of resources that are proposed by the model are based on the judgment of educators. So what is a good class size? What is an effective class size? How many additional support staff are needed in a school of this size versus that size? What are all of the inputs that are required to run a school really well? Now, some of those factors, like class size, there's some rigorous research using statistical methods about that point to the effectiveness of lower class sizes versus higher class sizes. That research is not conclusive. But if you talk to educators, they will tell you sort of the on-the-ground challenges of large class sizes and how much more effective their teaching could be if class sizes were smaller. And so based on the judgment of educators and people like me who study resources in the education arena, the model specifies the level of inputs needed to run effective schools. Now, there obviously will be disagreements about how many counselors you might want to have versus assistant principals, or whether you can have higher class sizes in some subject areas but need lower class sizes in other subject areas or other grades. But based on the research that the commission reviews, what's in the model is really sort of consistent with what the education, both the education delivery research and the education funding research, says is an effective both level and distribution across uses of resources. That's just sort of a winding way of saying that the model is not highly statistical in its relationships. It's based largely on judgments of educators and what resources are required to maximize student learning. The research on connecting spending to student outcomes is also inconclusive, and so trying to build a purely statistical model is really not feasible, given the current level of knowledge.
There's quite a bit of subjectivity in the development.
Absolutely.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Streeter, and thank you, Co-Chairs, for being here. I just wanted to point out about that in the, I read the last two, and one of the things that was discussed, I can't remember in which one, but was indeed the fact that over time, even though we continue to historically underfund based on this, we have had over time improvement and efficiencies in, you know, improvements in our outcomes. So, and it's interesting because whichever it was talked about that as being you in a construction or whatever you would call that as being more efficient with your resources. And so there was some conversation about despite the chronic underfunding, we do indeed continue to have some increasing rates and responses and achievements, and despite still being below where we would want to be and where we believe the full funding would or could get us. I guess there's certainly a question in there.
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, I think that's absolutely right. We've seen Oregon's graduation rate over the last roughly 10 years since we started using the cohort method of calculating it has gone up from the high 60% to about 75% last year. So that it's not a huge increase, but it's impressive given that it happened over a period. I mean, that started in the period right in the worst of the most recent recession. And so at a time not only when funding has been flat, but was actually down because of the recession. So the model is implemented as what we call prototype schools. There's an elementary, a middle, and a high school in the model. The sizes are the elementary school is 340 students, the middle school is 500 students, and the high school is 1,000 students. Again, those are based on research that says those are the sizes of schools where they can be most efficiently run. We often hear that, well, wouldn't bigger schools be more efficient because you can spread costs of principals and other activities over more students, so the per student cost goes down. What's left out of that argument is that bigger schools often suffer from, they're often less capable of delivering an effective education because of size itself. They're harder to manage. Students can get lost in the shuffle. It's harder to know all the students in a school that gets really large, and so that sort of sweet spot where efficiency of delivery is maximized is roughly these sizes of schools that are in the model. Some work that I did, probably 15 years ago here at the department that looked at that question, essentially a question of economies of scale, showed that as schools, really small schools are very expensive because you may have class sizes of 5 to 10 students, which are really inefficiently small. Yeah. You don't lose much by going from 10 up to 15 or even 18 or 20 students. You don't lose much in teacher effectiveness. But as the school size for a high school, for example, as it gets to about 1,200, the cost starts to go back up, the cost of delivering a given level of student learning starts to go back up. For middle schools, it's around 500 to 600, and for elementary, it's around 300. So the size of the schools in the model are right in that same range. So we feel good about that we have the right size of schools in the model. We're often told by school districts, well, our schools aren't those sizes. Ours are either smaller or larger than that. So why does the model have anything useful to say to me? And I don't have a great answer to that, other than the model is not intended to be representative of any given school. It's intended to be representative of effective schools. and also it's intended to take a statewide look, not a district-level look or a school-level look. We have other techniques of doing that, but the model is not intended to do that.
And that would also be true, wouldn't it, of the size of school districts? For example, you would think that the larger school district would be more efficient, and to a degree, I guess they are, but the biggest school district in the state certainly is not the most efficient.
Co-chairs,
I know I represent part of them.
Yeah. Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, yeah, in the work I did, I also looked at district size and sort of the minimum cost district size, minimum cost per student,
yeah,
was in the 10 to 15,000 range, not the 40 or 50,000 range that some of the districts in Oregon are at now.
Yep.
So the costs don't go up very rapidly. They go up very slowly as you get bigger,
yeah,
but they certainly don't go down anymore once you get past about 15,000.
Okay. Thank you.
And the model over time has, as we've gathered more and more detailed data at the Department of Revenue, both on the funding side and on the student side, has gotten much more detailed, and so we think the model is more accurate because of the increased detail and the better data that we have that we put in the model. Quick overview of how the model actually works. For each of the prototype schools, we have what we call the inputs or the components, which are staff, primarily teachers, and then all those things that go along with running a school. So we have a principal and in middle and high schools, assistant principals, and then you have counselors, and you have support staff of a variety of types, business managers, and so forth. Educational assistants, school nurse, all those things that it takes to run a school. And then we put prices on those. So for teachers, it's their salary plus their benefits. That's the price of a teacher. That's the price of any staff. And then we price out supplies and services that they purchase, utilities that they purchase, just sort of all the mundane stuff that it takes any organization to run, copying and printing and custodial and all of those things. Those are all in the model, and we have prices on those so that we can estimate the total cost of running each of the prototype schools, and then we scale that up to the state level, depending on how many students we have in the state and how many schools that we would need to serve them.
Yeah.
One thing that we started doing with the model maybe 10 years ago was, instead of just estimating what it would cost to run the fully implemented model, we realized that that's not terribly useful if you don't know where you are today. And so we now estimate what we call the baseline, which is at current funding levels, what do class sizes look like? What do number of teachers look like? What do number of other inputs look like? What's the quantity of those? And then we can, instead of just looking at fully implementing the model, we can say, what if we do a few of the things that the model suggests? Lower class sizes, more counselors. So we can do those sort of what I call policy scenarios. Instead of just saying we have to do the entire thing at once, we can say, if the legislature decides they can appropriate $200 million more dollars in a particular biennium, what does that buy? How many more teachers does that buy? How much would that reduce class sizes in elementary schools? So forth. And then help to make decisions about what's the most effective way to use additional dollars, even if it's not the full amount required to fully fund the model. So we also have what we call a student performance component of the model, and early on in the model, we we simply looked at trends in test scores and trends in graduation rates. But now that we have a lot of student-level data, we can actually predict high school graduation rates and the probability that a student with given characteristics in a school with given characteristics will graduate from high school. And so it's a case where we actually do estimate a very sophisticated statistical model because we have the data that allows us to do that. And we do that because it can give us some hints at where additional spending might have the biggest impact. For example, the correlation between attendance and graduation is very high, or looked at differently, the correlation between being chronically absent and graduation is very high and negative. Which suggests that devoting more resources to do things that are more engaging to students and to help them want to be in school may have a dramatic impact on graduation rates. So it's a tool to help us better understand how resources can best be spent to get the most positive impact for students.
Well, school attendance has a lot to do with parenting, too.
Absolutely. But it also has to do with whether kids want to be in school.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that schools can do to make that happen.
Yeah.
And we have some really interesting examples of that around the state.
Mr. Chair, I just feel the need to point out it also has a lot to do with poverty. It has a lot to do with transportation challenges that come with poverty.
So I won't go into detail on this. This just talks about some of the changes and enhancements that we've made over the years to the model to improve it and make it more accurate. And then sort of a listing of the research topics that the commission has undertaken, exploring best practices, both looking at the national research literature and doing our own analysis here in Oregon with Oregon data in conjunction with partners like Department of Ed, Chalkboard Project, other entities that work in Oregon that are looking into how to improve outcomes in our schools.
And Mr. Reeder, this is available at ODE. The research topics that were there reports or any conclusions from these or
Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Doherty, yes. We have on our website we have research that my office has done over the years on subjects related to graduation rates, impacts of attendance and absenteeism and so forth.
Okay, thank you.
Talked a little bit about what we call the student achievement model, which is the detailed model that follows individual students over the grades as they progress through school to identify factors that may influence whether or not they successfully complete high school. Some of the things that we found in that research, early learning, particularly high quality pre-K, has been found by a large number of studies to have a long-term positive impact on kids. A lot of it in what people have called non-cognitive or soft skills that often don't show up in test scores, but do show up in kids staying in school, kids persisting in high school and actually graduating, whereas in the past they may not have. And so those social skills and so forth that are learned in the early grades turn out are very important.
And you said that one of the things that we need to do a better job of is is providing students with things that they're interested in, activities, after-school activities, those kinds of things. Unfortunately, many school districts actually charge fees for some of those things, and so you get to where Representative Smith Warner, that poverty becomes a major factor. I'm always troubled when I read that a particular school district is charging kids a fee to be involved in after-school sports or other activities, the chess club or whatever it be. I think that's doing a disservice to kids that come from a poverty background.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, that's consistent with the research findings that I've seen, some work we've done at the department, not at the student level because we don't have extracurricular indicators for individual students, but at the school level, the higher share of students that participate in those activities, those schools have higher graduation rates.
Yeah.
So that seems fairly clear. But even in the regular school day, and I think a current example is career technical education, students who what we call concentrators, CTE concentrators, those students who follow a particular program of career technical education courses, have much higher graduation rates across all student groups, low-income students, students of color.
Yep.
And so that's an example of a program that appears to me to be very engaging for a lot of students and very effective in getting them through and to high school graduation. I think the common thread in many programs that seem effective is an element of engagement, providing kids a program or presenting your basic core courses in a way that resonates with them and makes them want to come to school is a key piece in getting them to finish.
Yeah.
Some of the things we look at, graduation rates for boys are 7 to 8 points lower than they are for girls, even when they do as well on standardized tests. So there's something non-academic that appears to be going on there. Economically disadvantaged students, again, something even when they do well in academically, they still have barriers to graduation that other students don't necessarily face. Attendance rates. And then something we've got some really good news on lately is what we call ninth grade on track. At the end of ninth grade, have students earned a quarter of the credits needed to graduate from high school, and that percentage jumped up dramatically in the 16-17 school year. So we're very encouraged by that because that's highly correlated with graduation as well.
And Brian, there's something I'm very interested in because some of us, most of us on this committee, fought very hard to get full-day kindergarten for all students. And it's going to be a few years before we can see what an impact that has had in terms of success in school on down to the third grade and to the ninth grade and graduation records. So I'm hoping that you're keeping good statistics on what happened before we had full day kindergarten and what the rates were on down the line, and now what that is going to be for when all Oregon students have an opportunity for full day kindergarten.
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, absolutely, we're able to follow students over time, both the cohorts that were in kindergarten back in the half-day days and now students who are in kindergarten in a full-day program. And we can observe how well they're doing. But as I mentioned, third-grade test scores, fifth-grade test scores may not tell us everything we need to know because some of the benefit to those early grades is some of those non-cognitive skills that are going to show up in persistence later. You know, high school can be really hard, and it may be the first time that some students are really challenged in a serious way. And
didn't happen to me till college.
Yeah. Some of those skills that they learn in the early grades help them get through that in a positive way. And so it's going to be a while before we know the full impact of
well,
that.
I know I was so frustrated because many school districts that were offering full-day kindergarten charged a fee for the second half. And, of course, that fee was affordable for the upper income, but not for the ones in poverty. And so those that probably needed it the worst weren't getting it. And now we've changed that. The legislature has finally gotten that accomplished, and it's going to be remarkable to see what the results are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if we could see,
Representative Doherty?
Well, no, I was just going to say we've got about 55 minutes left for everybody else.
I'm talking
and
too
I
much.
Wanted to.
So I'll finish very quickly here. This graph, and you'll find this graph in the report, mm-hmm. in the full report that's on our website too, but this shows the estimated impact of various programs or interventions on the high school graduation rate. And this is based on estimates that come out of that, what we call the student achievement model. So the dark line across the bottom is just sort of a trend that we're on right now. And then the lines above it are the impacts of various interventions that have a particular impact. So the first line up is reducing and eliminating the graduation gap between males and females. So if we brought the graduation rate for boys up to the level that girls are currently at, we get a bump of about 3 percentage points in the graduation rate, overall graduation rate. Reducing it for economically disadvantaged students is that third line up, the long dashes.
The chartered by the Redmond School District.
The next line up is the impact of improving attendance. And that you can see, these are cumulative, so the impact is the distance above the prior line. And that attendance one is quite large. The next one is all students on track at the end of ninth grade. And so that's about 2 percentage points. So we're encouraged that that percent went up dramatically last year, and it should show up as a couple percentage point boost in the graduation rate 3 years from now. And then the last one is the impact of an early reading initiative, so that kids are reading at grade level at the end of third grade, and that boosts graduation rates eventually by another couple points. I guess the lesson on some of these is that it takes time to work through the system. When you provide interventions and have early success in the early grades, it takes a little bit of patience because it's not going to show up in high school graduation rates for 6-7 years. Yeah. But we need to start early because that's where a lot of the most effective programs can be implemented. And the last slide I've got is just the funding table that we present in the full report that shows that the funding gap that we estimated, and this was prior to the legislative session that appropriated money. So we estimated that the current service level was that top number in the middle, 7.9, 7.8.5, or 7.9 billion,
the legislature actually appropriated $8.2 billion, so that's good. The legislature added resources above the level needed to just maintain where we were at in 15-17. So the estimated gap that we had was $1.99 billion, but because the legislature actually appropriated more than we anticipated, that gap is smaller than shown here. The QEM report always comes out prior to the legislative sessions as a way to inform the legislature about where we're at and what the model says where we'd like to be. So we'll stop there.
Thanks, Brian.
If you have further questions.
You can hear from these nice ladies now. Senator Wilkin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The previous graph. So by looking at that, we're saying that we don't know, we have no initiatives in place, we haven't thought about it, we haven't identified that other 10% gap, right? So there's another, that gets to 90%. So if we wanted to get to 100%, there's other things out there we're going to have to do. We just don't know what they are. Is that fair to say?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, Senator Vader. I'm sorry, Roblin.
Yes, it works either way.
These were examples, and I think these were examples of what we think are the most effective strategies. But there are others that we could point to. So I don't think it's correct to say we don't know.
Okay.
There are a number of strategies shown to be effective. I don't think we know how. I don't think we know everything we need to know to get to 100%. But I think there are strategies in addition to these that could get us above 90 if they were implemented well.
Senator Roblin?
Identify yourself, too, just so
I'm
for the
sorry.
Record.
Sarah Bowley, co-chair. And formerly, I retired as a deputy superintendent out of Beaverton Schools. So I spent nearly 40
push
years.
Push the microphone in. Just a little bit closer to you. You don't have to.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I've been listening with great interest your conversation about best practices and the importance of determining how schools are actually using their resources, because we've really determined that that's probably as important, if not more important, than the amount that they are actually being allocated. And having conducted as part of the best practices panel, working with the team that conducted that research, and doing a literature review of best practices across the United States, we know there isn't a lot of evidence to support that class size reduction in and of itself is going to make the differences people want it to make. Now, in concert with other strategies that we're discovering in our really effective schools, it truly probably will help. But schools may use the staffing differently than just to reduce class sizes. So I'm just going to throw that out there and let you know that has been how schools spend their money has been a major focus of the last three report cycles of the best practices panel, which is the QEC's research arm that seeks to look at what is happening at the site and produce both qualitative and quantitative evidence as to what's really making a difference. So this is in no small measure inspired by the fact that at least since our state report cards, we've been able to scan the state and see that we have some really amazing schools. They are exceptional in that they are able to change the outcomes for students who are historically at risk of graduating from our high schools and going on to post-secondary education. And we know who those populations are. There are economically deprived students, our boys, our non-white students, LEP students, special ed students. They have all become the focus of our research over these three report cycles. And And we've been, our major research question is, how are these high schools making a difference when there are other high schools that are very similar in terms of their demographic student profiles and even their local economies, and who aren't? Yeah. And it isn't for lack of trying. I want to make that really clear. All of our high schools, I believe, all of our schools really in the state are determined to make a difference for kids, and it is heartbreaking when they can't. And what we've discovered is they may be using strategies that they think will work, but there is no evidence to support that, whereas there are other strategies emerging, largely teacher-driven, that are making a difference in Oregon. And we'll be reporting on those in our next report. This is the first time I can say, you know, I think we really have confidence that we have unearthed through 3 years of everything from case studies to match pair studies, surveys, and as much discussing with people as we can who are also experts in the field, an emerging sea change in education in Oregon. And it's actually evolving throughout the United States and other parts of the world. And there are several elements of it. I'll just mention that one is a tremendous amount of teacher leadership is enacted that acts as a catalyst that really helps schools pull together and implement a school improvement plan that is student-centered. So they need a lot of collaboration time to get this done, to pull it off, because what they have to do is spend time looking at data, so they need a background in data analysis. They really need more sophisticated skills in analytical areas. But then they also work with their fellow teachers to determine which interventions students really need. And then they use flexible grouping to divide up students in such a way that they can really deliver whatever it is those students need. So they're personalizing education. So they really are finding a way to do it. But it's still in its infancy in Oregon, which is why your conversation about how much money do you allocate to what you see as being promising practices is really relevant. It takes careful study. But it's exciting to be able to let you know that we will be releasing information about the five top really practices we feel are most common to these schools that are making a big difference. And these are schools in all locales in Oregon, and actually at all levels. We see it's been happening at elementary for a bit longer. That probably goes back to Title I funding and the fact that elementary teachers can really focus on a smaller number of students, whereas your secondary teachers may really be looking at student loads of like 200 at the high school level. So there's way too much to go into here right now, but I just want you to know that that is another arm of research that is ongoing as part of the QEC, and it has been tremendously helpful to have ODE, and Brian there to help us with expanding our analytical capacity, because now we are able to do more research. But basically what's happening is we have schools that are figuring out how to personalize education. Now, there is a caveat here. They are desperate for more collaboration time. They really want to work more with each other, probably in the same way medical teams would be working in a hospital. This is not wasted time. And in some schools, they're using schedules so creatively that, they may actually add an extra period into a teacher or release a teacher for a period who, say, teaches writing, and they know they have a big group of ninth graders who really need a lot of additional help, and that person will help facilitate that. But that requires extra funding. What doesn't work quite as well over time, because it's really hard on teachers, and parents don't like it particularly well either, is releasing teachers to do this work through subs or paying them extended contract, because they're always already working almost 24/7 as it is. But anyway, we have some great members on the QEC who are practitioners, who are very connected, and they what they're telling us is that our teachers are developing tremendous professional competency and capital, because they really are proving that they can make a difference. And then that inspires more great change. And then the social capital is really critical, too, because these are teachers who are also able to connect with teachers and other supports at the transition level. So they're actually reaching out more with this time to our colleges, universities, and they're able to connect more to other opportunities for funding. So the next step really is to figure out what this is costing and really take another step toward determining how promising it really is. And I think it's a movement, and it's been ongoing for probably 20 years. And our state was one of the early leaders in personalizing education and teaming. So we've lost ground throughout this you know, economic situation we're in, this crisis we're in. But there's still a really strong knowledge base and an absolute determination to ensure more equitable outcomes for kids.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Monroe.
And Beth?
Yeah, just a couple of things. Beth Giroux, I was an 18-year member of the Eugene School Board, now retired, and I'm past president of the Oregon School Boards Association. So a lot of what I've seen is traveling the state with the Oregon School Boards Association and seeing some of the differences in our communities, large, small, rural, urban. And for me, that was striking to understand somewhat the challenges and opportunities with each of those. I would echo what Sarah has said. I think a couple of other things that we've talked about at the commission is looking at the source of funding. And I know in our district, we rely a lot on grants to implement new best practices into the district. We don't have a way of tracking, apart from the state school fund, how much school districts are receiving in the way of grants to implement best practices. And so that's something that we've been talking about. One of the things going with the collaboration and ownership of learning is that I think it's important that we look at the high school, and we implemented a practice in 4J of fully scheduling ninth graders and then 10th graders, and now we're looking at 11th graders. And we're finding tremendous success in those students because they're actually coming to school on a full-time basis. They're establishing those relationships. The other thing that we've been talking about, which Sarah touched on, is the implementation of best practices. And we've seen quite a bit of variation across the state in how best practices are implemented. So what some districts can call teacher collaboration is not actually teacher collaboration, but rather teachers getting together and hearing a top-down edict about what they should be doing and talking about how they're going to do that. So the ownership of teaching by teachers and having strong teacher leaders is absolutely critical. And that takes time, and time costs money.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all of you. And we have a couple more people we need to hear from, so thank you very much. Mr. Cannon. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner. Good morning. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the State's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And I will be very brief. I have little in the way of prepared remarks and no PowerPoint. But this commission, this committee is responsible, first of all, for the determination about whether or not ballot measure one and the associated statutory language compels you to make a determination on post-secondary funding and its adequacy. We can talk about that. I think ultimately, I think this committee over the years has sort of gone back and forth about whether or not the ballot measure does require a report or a determination about adequacy of post-secondary funding. If you were to decide that you did need to make that determination about whether the state appropriation has been adequate, and if not, issue a report, From the standpoint of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, our view would certainly be that the state appropriation is not sufficient to meet the goals that the commission has. Those goals are implied, at least, by the state's 40-40-20 goal, and we can talk again more about that. But our view has been that the state appropriation is not sufficient to meet the state goals. As a commission, one of our responsibilities is to present, to adopt a comprehensive budget recommendation for post-secondary education that's aligned with state goals. And so we've used 40-40-20 and then our own commission goal setting process to try to, as the starting point for a commission conversation about what a truly adequate post-secondary budget would look like. That's been reflected partly in the agency request budgets that we have submitted to over the last several cycles to DAS and the governor's office, and portions of which ultimately become part of the legislative conversation. In addition to the HECS work over the last several years to determine whether, you know, what would be adequate in order to meet state goals, back in 2009, 2010, then-Governor Kulongoski established a post-secondary quality education commission that undertook, I would say, a more rigorous and robust process of determining what would be required in order to meet state goals. Again, at that time, 40-40-20 was under discussion and was kind of the guiding, sort of the guidepost for what that appropriation would have to be. So we have that work to draw from. And then the sort of the final point I'll make is that going forward, again, back to the commission, as we begin work on our 2019 budget recommendations, we will again be engaging stakeholders and the public, and certainly our commission, in a process to determine what kind of state investment would be necessary in order to reach our ambitious state goals. I will note, and I know it's on all of your minds, and the work of the QEC, I think, is instructive in this regard. This isn't merely a question about sort of how much funding. It's also funding for what? For what type of education? For what type of quality education? What does that look like? And through what mechanism should that funding be delivered? From my commission's standpoint, my commission's point of view is that we need, in preparation for 2019, to have that bigger picture conversation. What are we attempting to invest in? What type of system are we trying to create in order to efficiently deliver these goals for student educational attainment? So that's our intent over the coming months. It'll be, of course, it's up to you how to, proceed with respect to the ballot measure language and the constitutional requirement and the associated statutory language this cycle. But our view certainly is that the current appropriation is not sufficient. We have some evidence both past and underway on why that is the case and what those gaps are.
Questions for Mr. Cannon? Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson. Morning, Doug.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. What I plan to do here is basically go through what the resource model is or what the available resources are to determine that gap. And I'll go fast because I know the witching hour is approaching. This graph shows for 17-19 the amount of general and lottery funds that are in the 17 or this alleged adopted budget by the major area across. Generally, the amounts in each of these areas have not changed that much from the previous biennia. The exception to that is, and it's rather small, is the Department of Education, the other education pie that includes early learning. But the big driver in an increase there of a roughly 39% is ballot measure 98. That $170 million is included in that slice. And I want to come back to that later in the presentation. State school fund up about 10.1%, post-secondary up about 10.5%, and the total amount of that general and lottery funds across all parts of the state budget went up about 10.3%. So the education components are the large ones, assistance to are the post-secondary and the state school fund grew roughly at what are the amount across the entire budget. I must say, though, keep in mind that that state school fund amount does not include about $81 million in marijuana funds, and I will include that number in future slides. The only one that went down with any significance is public safety and judicial. The next graph shows the education for those that are old enough to remember the Pac-Man game, which I played back in high school or college. This is what I call the education Pac-Man graph. And it's not derogatory in any way, but that state school fund does represent three quarters, roughly, of the education budget, and probably therefore should be, considering the number of students it assists when compared to other areas of the budget. Generally, other than for that Department of Education budget, again, due to Measure 98, most of them stayed relatively close to what they were in terms of shares for the education area. I should note that this does not include the Chief Education Office or the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission because they come in at less than 0.1% of the budgets in each of those slices. They'd be lost in the chart.
Representative Wisner.
Oregon Promise, Mr. Wilson. Where's Oregon Promise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, that is included in the support for community colleges.
Thank you.
If you're wondering about the state school fund, it is usually the amount we use to determine the gap that you've discussed already with the QM model. In 15-17 biennium, that amount was 76% of the budget. Now it's 74% in terms of what you see in the 17-19. But again, keep in mind that that does not include the ballot measure 98 funds, which are $170 million, which is a grant and aid program.
Madam Co-Chair.
And just to clarify, Doug, so that is in that $170 million is under the Department of Education.
Yes, that is right. And I also should note on this graph, the title there, the first line where it says 2015 to 17, that should read 2017 to 19. I caught that this morning. Too late to change. I do recycle graphs.
Senator Rokowicz.
And while we're on it, catching, you know, Doug, in the future, some of us are blind, so try and use 14 font in the future so we can see it.
That's true.
We don't all have our computer in front of us glued to it, so thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Real quick, Mr. Wilson, because I know you have this data. Opportunity grants plus Oregon Promise total up, down, work, you know.
Mr. Chair, number. Representative Wisnett, it would be up. Opportunity grant went up $5-6 million. I'd have to go back and check to the exact amount. The Oregon Promise is a little harder just because it was phased in. So it went from roughly 13 million in 15-17 to 40 million, 40. But a lot of that is just the 1 year nature in 15-17. So it would have significant roll-ups. As I mentioned, the school fund or the formula revenue, keep in mind that the formula revenue includes both the local and the state resources, and then that amount is used as sort of a total resource in the distribution of those general fund or the general purpose funding for school districts, for a lack of better term. Turn one, two bitty pages here. You'll notice that in terms of the state general fund, it's by far the amount, the largest amount of roughly 63%. But between the two, the local and state shares, the state share represents 67.3% of that total formula revenue. And the local share, mainly property tax and timber tax revenues, represents 32.7%. In 1517, the state share was 66.8. The local share was 33.2. So you've seen a little growth proportionally in the state share and a slight decrease in the local share. That amount bounces around biennium depending on depending both on the growth of property taxes, but more so on the condition of the state budget and what's happening.
So the two-thirds, one-third basically has remained relatively constant?
Relatively constant, within a few percentage points.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, the all other local revenues, are those things like local options, that kind of thing?
That makes up part of it. I'd have to go back up because it makes up such a small, small share.
Okay. Thank you.
But and that would be property taxes, right?
Not the state other or the all other local revenue. I have to go back and check. Probably it is good. Not property tax, though.
On levies, canceling.
Okay.
And please keep in mind that the Ways and Means Committee is not the keeper of the formula and everything. That really is the Revenue Committee's responsibility. And we get accused of venturing into that every once in a while, but I'm using this just for demonstration.
Well, some of us would like to do it more.
Some of us would like you not to do it more.
Just for comparison's sake, we talked about recessions and sort of what happens during those times. This just represents the 09-11. It's that same pie as the previous slide, but you see it's much more complicated. You'll see that we're starting to add some federal stimulus funding into that, made up 4% of the total formula resources. You have Education Stability Fund as well as the Rainy Day Funds. There are sort of two Rainy Day Funds that are available to the state budget, education specifically. So, and there, you know, even at that time period, the state share was roughly 65% and the local share was 35%, again, within a couple percentage points. Now, of course, Measure 5, that was almost flipped.
Flip-flop.
Over time, you have from 03-05 to 17-19, sort of that split between shares of state and local. Between the 15 and 17 budget and the 17 and 19 budget, the overall growth in the formula, both the local and state shares, grew about 10.3%. The state share grew a little faster than the local share, mainly because the growth in local property taxes was a little less than what the state was putting in. But you see the change over time there. You'll also notice back, we actually reduced from one biennium to another, the 07-09 to the 09-11, and that was the height of the recession and coming out of the recession, even with the use of some of those rainy day funds and federal stimulus dollars.
Doug, the boss here says you need to put your full name and who you stand, what you're doing, and so on the record.
My name is Doug Wilson, legislative fiscal staff, for the record.
Thank you.
I thought it was Maz and he was from LRO.
That's right.
You're venturing into that territory.
He's ignoring you, Senator.
No, I would never ignore the Senator.
Never.
I'm just taking into account the time that's left. This is for 17-19. This is the distribution of that total formula revenue pie. And this, what I'm doing here is just saying there are statewide issues, which are sometimes referred to as carve-outs. In the formula, as well as what's distributed to school districts. I think the important nature here, or important note, is to take a look at the statewide amount of the what goes into quote-unquote statewide functions, which is less than 0.8% of 1%, and how much is distributed to school districts, well over 99%. But even many of those statewide uses either go for students that aren't part of the distribution formula, school for the deaf, long-term care, pediatric nursing, or they are grants to districts, like in the English language learners. Much of that money, almost all of it, goes out to districts. School nutrition goes out to districts. And then finally, the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning goes out as grant and aid payments for mentoring, school district collaboration, and some other uses. Most of that $39 million goes out to districts too. So it does show that even though we get some resistance in terms of carving out money, almost all of the carve-outs also go to districts, just in a different form than the general purpose grant. Moving on, to keep your time, there are lots of other spending in the K through 12 realm. In that grant and aid portion, or the Department of Education slice of the first pie, School for the Deaf receives a little over $12 million of general and lottery funds. There is debt service in terms of general lottery funds. Almost all of that is the new facilities grant program, or whatever the official title of that program is, where it's helping districts build new buildings or major renovations or improvements. And then the grant and aid programs is a large chunk of money, much larger than it used to be, given that $170 million for the ballot measure 98 grants, that will likely grow to significantly more, another $100 million roughly next biennium as it's rolled out, if the legislature determines that it wants to fund it the full sort of ballot measure formula allocation. In the past, when we're measuring that gap you discussed earlier, we have only used the state school fund amount to measure that gap. Mr. Reeder and I have had a real short preliminary discussion about maybe we need to include some other things in that state resources, mainly because of this ballot measure 98. We're talking about real money now in excess of $170 million. So we're going to have some discussions here in the next couple of weeks, I think, to see how we should approach that.
Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Wilson, on this page, we have English language learners getting $10.4 million. In the previous slide, it was the $12.5 million. So is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, the difference is the amount of money that's in the staff and other assistants in the department. So it's not a grant and aid going out to districts, but there is some of the money used for the staff within ODE. Okay. And that would represent the
Mr.
difference.
Co-Chair.
Go ahead.
So this is not, this $10 million is not part of the $12.5 million?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisner, it is part of the.
Is it?
Yes, and the difference is up in the first line in this graph in the Department of Education operations.
Give me my $2 million for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, Ms. Miller asked me to spend a little time on post-secondary. As soon as I figure out how we get this, this is that same type of display in terms of the amount we totally spend on post-secondary in the 17-19 budget. You'll notice the largest two slices of pie represent about 64% or almost two-thirds of the budget. These are the general support payments to either public universities or community college. The other areas that are sizable here is funding that goes to other public university functions. This is mostly extension, experiment station, forest research labs, the statewide programs, sports lottery, those things. We do provide significant assistance through debt service for both community colleges and public universities. OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University, receives some funding from the state, mainly for its educational activities as well as the for debt service. And you'll notice there's $21.8 million of general fund and lottery fund debt service in that pie. And that is generally the Knight Cancer Institute plus a little other bit of funding. And then there's the Oregon Opportunity Grant for $146 million. So that makes up components of post-secondary education programs. Public universities, real briefly, shows the division between the various components of the assistance the state gives to the to the public universities. Again, the public university support fund, that sort of basic support, represents the vast majority of it. And over time, you'll see a similar to the state school fund. There are years that it was actually reduced during the recession, in fact, significantly more than what the state school fund reduced by. But you'll notice since 11-13, there has been significant growth in the general support and the amount that we provide or assist with debt service. In fact, between the between 13-15 and 17-19, overall support for the debt service and the general support payments, as well as the statewide programs, have increased by about 46%. So it's a significant growth during that period as we've come out of that recession. Significantly higher growth in the K-12 area in terms of percentages. Moving them. Community colleges, this breaks down where the money for community colleges goes. We have included Oregon Promise Program in this breakdown because it only helps community college students. It really, though, is a student assistance payment, too. So it was sort of like, where do you include it? Again, Oregon Promise Program is ramping up, and that $40 million is not fully funding the program, which would be more in the $48 to $50 million program. So there are income or earned family contribution constraints being put on that. So not 100% of the students that were eligible last biennium are eligible this biennium for the program.
And the decision that our subcommittee made was to slightly means test the program because we didn't have sufficient resources to fully fund it.
In terms of community colleges, they are units of local government, so they do have property taxing powers, unlike the public universities. This shows the changes over time. In the bottom bluer, the darker blue is state support. The middle category there is the tax district, community college district tax revenues, and the top is tuition. The takeaway on this graph is that tuition has over time become more important as a funding source as the state support has fallen. Property tax revenue generally stays the same. In contrast, or just to show, back in 05-06, state support was 45%, tax or local taxes 23%, tuition 32%. At the height of the recession, as that community college support appropriation actually went down, the in 2010-11, the state support represented 31%, 24% for local tax revenues, and 45% for revenues or tuition revenues. For 15-16, the most recent data year we have available, tuition represented 38%. So it has, the state support has gone up, which has helped bring that tuition as a share of total revenues for community colleges down. Over time, this shows what's happened to state support for community colleges overall. Again, you see an increase between 13-15 and 17-19, not quite as significant in terms of percentage growth as public universities. If you factor out Oregon Promise, which is a relatively new program, from 13-15 to 17-19, you saw about 24-25% growth over that two biennium period. You still see the same pattern during the recession years of the amount going down in actual terms between 09-11 and 11-13.
I just got to say, that's really, really frustrated me, because there's one thing we need during a recession, it's more workforce development. It's training people that have lost their jobs for the jobs of the future. And at that very time, we cut back support to community colleges where that kind of training takes place. It's really destructive in terms of are working our way out of these downturns and helping Oregonians prepare for the jobs of the future when they need it the most. I'll get off my soapbox now.
I just wanted to point out sort of the trends in community college students. During the recession, they went up significantly in terms of student FTE, which sort of measures of an FTE being a full-time student. I think it's 15 credits for three quarters during the year. So at the same time we were cutting the state support, the number of students were growing significantly, and therefore the tuition revenue as a share went significantly up. But at the same time, as we've increased community college support in the past few biennia, the number of students in terms of a student FTE has actually fallen. So it's another thing to sort of keep in count the both the dynamics, but also on how you're looking at where to allocate money. It has not necessarily in community colleges been geared toward the number of FTE or student number of students. It's more of what's available at the state level. The trends for public university students are similar, but not as significant or as pronounced. And so it did grow a little bit during the recessionary times, but it hasn't fallen off as much, which when you think about the typical four-year college public university student and a two-year or certificate community college student, it does make sense. The other note on this one is just to show that over time there's been a continuous growth of non-resident students, both full-time and part-time, or in terms of numbers of students and FTEs, excuse me, it has continued to grow and is becoming a more important source of revenue since they do pay a higher tuition rate to a few of the campuses specifically, including U of O.
Do they keep track of how many of those non-resident students end up staying in Oregon, end up working in Oregon and paying taxes in Oregon, or how many of them just come, take advantage of our top-notch universities and then leave?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure whether they do or not. I would have to check with the public universities or HEC. I do not believe HEC does specifically.
I'd sure like to know.
The creation of the longitudinal data system as that comes online might help you with that, because employment data is one of the elements in that longitudinal data system. Okay. And finally, the last slide just shows the Oregon Opportunity Grant, what has happened, and both showing the number of students served as well as the amount of spending over time. It has, I will note that there was a significant change in 09-11. The 09-11 biennium, a lot of money was spent in the first year, and you were not able to identify resources in the second year of that biennium. So there was a major decline in the amount of money and the amount of students served. The public universities, at that time OUS, the campuses of OUS, did step in and to soften that significant decrease. But you will notice since the recession, the amount of funding has steadily climbed again. And I believe that is all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yep. Questions for Mr. Wilson? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I do have a series of questions for Mr. Wilson and for Mr. Reeder, but I will put them in writing and send them, and I would ask them both to share with the co-chairs. I mean, my perspective, having come from the Revenue Committee, as I will apologize to the Quality Education Commission right now. I actually have a now higher regard for you than I did when I was in revenue. So I know, but it's just open Pandora's box to a series of questions to make Mr. Wilson's life miserable. And so, but I will refrain today, and I will submit them in writing.
Okay.
And I will copy you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted, while you were here, Mr. Wilson, so the conversation that perhaps we need to have either resolve or consider today is that idea about whether we can and should include some of that initiative funding that we spend outside of the state school fund in the where we are spending versus what the QEM would have us spend. So can you clarify, or maybe Mr. Reeder needs to, that historically we have only counted the state school fund numbers, period, in comparison to what the QEM...
He's been doing it a lot longer than I have, Madam Co-Chair, so I'll let him respond.
Mr. Reeder,
okay,
welcome
Co-Chair
back.
Smith, Warner, and Monroe. Early on, we focused solely on the state school fund, but now, well, in the past, we didn't fully account for all of those other sources of revenue, but we do now. Hmm. And so the process is to estimate the total cost of running the schools, subtracting all resources available other than the state school fund, including state grants and local property taxes and federal revenue. And then the remainder is the amount that would be required in the state school fund to fully fund the schools. Okay. So we are taking those into account now. We didn't fully in the past, but we are now.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Good.
Any additional questions?
I have a quick one.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, on slide 15, it's the community college graph that they have. What is an unduplicated headcount? It's on slide 15.
The unduplicated headcount is the total number of students, individual students. The FTE is a measure of a full-time equivalent, like we do for state employees in the budget process.
So someone could be taking one class or two classes
Right. Okay, so it's a much larger number because there are a number of part-time students.
Right. Thank you very much.
Good. Anything else? Thank you very much, gentlemen. And Ms. Miller?
Yes. I think now we're going to move on to next steps. And just for the record, for the ballot measure one presentation, the 2003-2005 report and 2013-2015 report were actually duplicated. So the 13-15 slide replicated the same, and that was an error on my part. But K-12 funding was still found insufficient. QEM recommended budget was $8.55 billion. And the extent of the insufficiency was $1.9 billion. So there was still an insufficiency. What I'll do is I'll just correct the PowerPoint and I'll send it out to everyone.
I wondered how.
Because I was going through the slides, Mr. Kutcher.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The, like, you showed the amount that we're short.
Mm-hmm.
But that amount compared to the overall percentage-wise is, you know, like, I think we started 1.5 and what, this last one was 1.9. But mm-hmm. the budget is significantly, so 1.9 billion short is a smaller percentage, isn't it, of the Brian left.
Yes. If I may, Mr. Co-Chair, one of the things I noticed, I was just skimming the most recent quality education report, and there was actually, I was going to point out to Ms. Miller, there's an excellent chart in there of each report and both the numerical difference and the percentage difference, so you can track it. So I would propose that rather than you recreating that, that is in that, because I was struck by that as well.
That's why I was reading it, too, but I think that it didn't give the – you have to look at the chart. It's complicated. You have to look at this, the data, the number on the left to see how the budget had gone
it
up.
It wasn't in actually the committee reports. It was actually in the QE in the quality education report. So,
That.
I so that's
–
and I was curious. I hadn't read that before either.
That's right. And Ms. Miller?
So was there another comment?
Just chatter.
So just the next step would be then to produce the report. As you know, our next meeting is November 14th from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. So if this committee agrees with the testimony that there's a gap in funding, and if the committee agrees to use the QEM as the comparison model, then I'll go ahead and draft that report. And then we have the next meeting on the 14th. And I think usually the way it works is it gets sent out typically about a week in advance, if that's the process that you guys are comfortable with. And then I know from the Vice Chair, Representative Wisnett's comments, to do some kind of report cross-comparing the reports, if that's something that the co-chairs are interested in pursuing. Yeah, like a matrix.
Yeah, I think I had made some notes about that, but I do think that you'll find that a lot of what we were looking for is in that quality education report.
Perfect. So we can just pull what's in the QE, the QEC's report.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I may be following my good colleague, Senator Boquist's lead on some of my specific comments slash recommendations about the drafting of this, because in reading the last two sets of reports, there's a fairly significant difference in the kinds of data. In the 13-15 report, there were a lot more specific subgroups of here's how we are doing on all of these achievement markers, mm-hmm. from third grade to eighth grade to ninth grade on track, et cetera, and broken down by subgroups.
Okay.
Whereas in the 15-17 report, there was only one, and it was just about graduation rates with the projections of where it would go if we didn't do anything else.
Okay.
And so I will write that and send it to you and copy the committee, but I would argue, I know there's always issues about from when we switch to Oaks to SBAC and other things like that, but I think that it's more useful to have more of that information to really give us the fuller sense of where our specific needs are, particularly if we're talking about if the Quality Education Commission is suggesting these, here's specific best practices that we think we should focus on, well, showing correspondingly where those specific gaps are in our kids' achievement.
Yeah, good, good.
Right, yeah, real quick, we get to talk, Mr. Co-Chair, do we have to decide as a committee whether we're going to address higher education or not? I based upon Executive Director Cannon's comments, we're still changing, the new governances and everything, and our role is, it makes it a little more difficult, I think, I don't know, do we have to as a committee or we have to report on the higher education community college?
Yeah, so from my standpoint, from the statute, it says that the Legislative Assembly, so I would argue that's this particular group, needs to decide whether or not there are quality goals established for post-secondary. And the last report, the decision was 40-40-20 is considered a quality goal, which is why then the measurements were produced for higher education. The issue with higher education is there's no model like the QEM to measure it and say, yes, there is insufficient funding and it's this dollar amount. There's no model for that. So we can still address it and discuss it like we did in the past, but there would be no marker like the QEM to really compare it to.
Okay.
But in statute, yes, that in my opinion, and then the way it's written, absolutely, if there are quality goals this committee deems are appropriate, then we would address in the report.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair,
go ahead.
Thank you. I would argue that, because I've been thinking the same thing, mm-hmm. that we don't have that model that you have in K-12. Yeah. But what we do have, if we are going to talk about 40-40-20, I would argue that we should at least talk about where it was, where we were towards that when mm-hmm. we first passed it, and each year since then.
Yeah.
That seems like it would make sense to have part of the the proposal.
Yeah.
But Senator Roblin might have another thought about that.
Well, we just changed that marker. If you know, in the last session, we are no longer using the whole population, but a subpoint of that population. So the 40-40-20 goal will look a little different. It didn't necessarily help us, but it is a different marker than it was previous to last session. And I just want to make sure we recognize that when we do that kind of look at the whole thing.
Okay. Anything else?
So the quality education model and our reports we've done for the past 10 years, where would we find those if we were looking on?
That's something I can email out to the group. They're available on OLIS, but it depends on the year. the two reports we have update are the last two, since that's historically how we've done them. But I can absolutely send those out.
What is clarification?
Senator Boquist.
Madam Counsel, are you saying that the most recent QEM Commission report?
Oh,
is
he was talking about QEM.
No, I was talking about our report.
Our report.
Okay. It's in OLIS.
Is it on OLIS
for
today? It is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So for
2016. The last two of them.
For the most recent report by the QEM, 2016, that is on OLIS for today. There's only one, because that's the one related to this particular body. In terms of the report we're going to produce, but in terms of the two reports I was talking about, it's the ones that this committee has previously produced.
Okay.
Well, so Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair. Ian, our present reports are the last two. Do they are they similar in terms of treatment of higher education? So that they're either, there's some portion is in of
yes.
those two reports?
Yeah, so the for the last one, if you look at it, it's about 27, or sorry, co-chairs and mm-hmm. senator. If the last one, if you look at it, it's about 27-something pages. It's only the last two pages that are in relation to post-secondary, yeah. which I did find interesting. And in my conversation with Doug Wilson and others, it's because there's no real model to determine whether or not funding is insufficient, like the QEM for higher education. But it does address absolutely 40-40-20.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Might I suggest that another part of how, in addition to having some of the statistics on where we are in 40-40-20, that perhaps part of our discussion is what might be some comparators we mm-hmm. could use, whether it's, well, that's really, sorry, heck. maybe that's too much of, you know, to be part of this, but going forward, it certainly seems, you know, since we are charged with this at some level, it seems to at least have that as part of the conversation. If we can do some comparators with other states of similar sizes and funding structures and how our percentages compare to theirs or something like that.
Well, we're very interested, of course, in proceeding in how we're proceeding with the Oregon Promise, for example, something there was a lot of discussion of and still a lot of discussion of, and it's new, and how we compare to Tennessee and all of those kinds of things.
It's probably a little specific for this broad of a report, but that's the right, yeah, that's the same kind of.
It's something new that we have injected into our HEC system over the last 2 years, really. And so reviewing how that's working out and what difference it's making would be useful, I think.
I would again argue that I agree, but not necessarily as part of this, because we have a deadline on this, and yeah. one staff person who has a whole lot of things to do.
She has other things to do. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I would agree that that's going forward. That is something we could definitely ask for in the interim in 2018, yep. whether it's the short session or after, on our subcommittee or in either one of the policy committees that are so okay. ably represented here.
Mr. Kocher, I guess I'd like to get you to set a little time aside here because I'm not so sure. I don't know whether I'm the expendable Senate member or I'm walking into an ambush. And I think on the Senate side, we need to have that discussion because I'm concerned of the next step. And it's not clear to me, based on the guidance I've had from the presiding officers, that I am expendable and that there actually might not be a next step, which then means we at least need to address a few of the issues that you have raised and Senator or Representative Wisnett has raised. I'm not sure our marching order is on the Senate side, is what I'm telling you. And I think I would like some of your time to understand that.
We have some change going on, just in case people didn't know.
Ambush is what I call it.
Marty and I are at your disposal.
Disposal is a key word, right, Doug?
Thank you, everybody, for a very good meeting. And we will see you again in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, November 14th.
Okay. Thank you. And this meeting is adjourned. Thank you. And this meeting is adjourned. Okay.